Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is November 27th, 2018, and this is episode 158. I'm the ghost, Mark Ames, coming to you from Telescope Audio Studios here in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. And I'm on the line with the Warner, Gary Bretcher, John Dolan, in Turin. John, how you doing? I know it's really late at night because you stayed up. Glory to John Dolan. You stayed up in order to record this interview with the authors of a great book on, I mean, nothing out there like it.
Those guys are great. People are really going to enjoy this interview. I don't know. I will be leaving Turin soon, so we'll finally have some new places to talk about. But in the meantime, I've been reading World War I novels and from non-Anglo sources, things that you've always vaguely heard about, like Henri Barbusse, Under Fire, French novel of World War I, and this Italian thing called it's in English as something about the Southern Front, but that's not how Italians saw it at all. Of course, the real title is A Year on the High Plains. And I'm working on that. I'm going to try to get more newsletters out and write a newsletter about those World War I novels. And also, last week we had a great field trip to the site of an urban insurgent killing in Turin at Piazza Stampali in the north side of town. It's a great story. I'm writing a newsletter about it now. And I hope that this will illustrate to a lot of people who are romanticizing urban insurgency right. that it's a nasty business.
Yeah. Well, and that's in a different setting, of course, but that's going to be the subject of our interview today about Al-Shabaab. I mean, it's a nasty insurgency and a really nasty business. And they do a good job also of sort of tracing sort of from the ground up that one guy, the young guy who sort of gets sucked into Al-Shabaab, becomes a killer, then has to start just, I mean, what's insurgency? A lot of it is killing people that this paranoid group is accusing of being spies. And you know, some of them are innocent. It's just a grim, dirty business. And we're not even talking about the families that get killed and the people's fingernails getting pulled out and so on. So, yeah. Anyways, let's get to our interview. We've talked it up a lot. Let's get to our interview with Haroun Maarouf and Dan Joseph. Okay, we are very honored to welcome onto the show today the co-authors of the book on Al-Shabaab. We have with us Haroun Maarouf. The co-authors are Haroun Maarouf and Dan Joseph. So Haroun Maarouf is senior editor of the VOA Somali service. And Dan Joseph is the VOA Voice of America editor in charge of the Africa desk. And he is the co-author of this excellent book. I really highly recommend you get it. Whether you think you kind of know enough about Al-Shabaab and how important this story is or not, it really illuminates a lot that's going on in sort of insurgencies. I mean, it's a lot of topics that we've or themes that we've developed on the show about insurgencies, counterinsurgency, and so on, really developed in depth in this book. Anyway, the book is called Inside Al-Shabaab, The Secret History of Al-Qaeda's Most Powerful Ally, and it's published by Indiana University Press. It just came out this year. Gentlemen, thank you for coming on the show. So, you know, it's tough to know where to start here. I think one of the things we need to do when we start this off the way we kind of try to approach some of these subjects, let's be honest that we don't know much about Somalia at all. And, you know, first of all, we want to go back, I think, in a bit of its history, because the history keeps playing out in different forms, even in the insurgencies of the last 10, 15, 20 years. But before I think we even do that, let's sort of talk about Somalia itself. I was surprised early on in your book to read that Mogadishu, the capital, the word itself comes from a Persian word. And how did that happen, I guess?
Mogadishu is a little bit like Jerusalem or other cities that were crossroads in the ancient world. Because of its location, you know, on the Horn of Africa, It was a meeting point for a lot of different cultures, African and Asian and Middle Eastern, and also Iranian, Persian. And Persians in the when you know around the year 10, 11, 1200, they were some of the merchants in Mogadishu, and the some elements of the, I guess it would be the Persian language, filtered into the city, and it acquired the name Mogadishu.
Let's talk about some basics about Somalia. I mean, so it's on the Horn of Africa, the Eastern Horn. I mean, it's sort of right across the sea from Yemen, which has been a subject of some of our shows as well. And it's sort of shaped, it's on the very corner there. I almost wanted to say, John, you're really good at kind of coming up with analogies here, but it kind of looks like a seahorse at a kind of 20, 30 degree angle with like the.
Or the greater than
Right.
symbol from an equation,
Right.
because it covers the coast along the Horn of Africa, and that means that right at the center, it veers sharply east. And of course, we're talking about Somalia as it's politically defined now, which
Right.
means it's not exactly, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not quite the same. It's not coextensive with the area populated by people who speak Somali or consider themselves Somali. There's a lot of inland Somali territory that's currently part of Ethiopia, known as the Ogaden, right?
Let me come in there. Somalia took independence from the Italian and British colonies in 1960. And at one time, Mogadishu was actually the most safest city in Africa. One important historical fact you should also know about Somalia is that in 1967, Somalia became the first African country where a transfer of power took place peacefully after a democratic election. So that's that bit of historical irony compared
Yes.
to the current situation and the violence we have seen during the last 30 years. In 1969, Mogadishu was a base for the largest KGB headquarters outside the Soviet Union,
Wow.
and it was a battleground for Cold War because Soviet Union was helping Somalia, train Somali army, and supporting the government. But as the gentleman mentioned it, Somalia and Ethiopia fell out over the Ogaden region, and then they engaged in bloody war in mid-1970s, and that's when Somalia cut relations with Soviet Union because Soviet Union took on the side of Ethiopia, and then Somalia tried to seek support from the United States. It did not receive all the support it needed, and Somalia lost the war. But in the middle of this war between Somalia and Ethiopia, there was also nationalism and the rise of new phenomena of ideology of Islamic extremism that emanated, that was coming from the Middle East, from from Saudi Arabia, from Egypt. And the background to this is Somalis are generally very moderate, largely Sufi, peaceful Muslims, and entirely Sunni Muslims. But in early 60s, a large number of Somalis went outside the country to study in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, in Sudan. And when they returned to the country in late 1960s, that's when this new phenomena came into the country. And the phenomena I'm talking about is political Islam, And I have to mention that most of the scholars who came back, their primary objective was just to teach people about Islam, activism, helping and setting up education centers. But as time went on, Salafism also arrived, and Salafism is where the new organization we're going to talk about has roots in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is an important point, and it's you guys helped sort of recover that really well early on in the book. I think most Americans, I don't know, maybe most Anglos might have this idea of, oh, Somalia, yeah, Black Hawk Down, it's complete chaos run by warlords. That must mean it was always like that. But actually, in that period of decolonization in the mid-20th century, Somalia, as you guys pointed out, was, first of all, it was one of the most stable places. As you said, it's the first African country where a democratically elected leader took power, you know, peacefully from the previous leader in 1967. That hadn't happened yet. So none of the current situation and chaos, there's nothing, you know, quote unquote, natural about it at all. And it was also very secular. And the warlords as well, going up to the 90s, were fiercely secular. And up through, I think, the early transitional government leader, Yusuf, I think these people were all very fiercely secular for a while. And it's only been more recently, right, that the Islamists have had so much power there. So these are really important background points to keep in mind when you think about Somalia. It's a horrible tragedy. We've seen this in a lot of places. It seems like, you know, another common problem we've been seeing with a lot of stories we've covered here, current war stories, is the fallout from what happens in a lot of the world, in the Muslim world, after the Afghanistan, the Soviet Afghanistan war ends and the Soviets pull out and some of these jihadis go back. I mean, and Somalia is one of the places that gets really hit by that, especially with the chaos. Anyway, so let's back up a little bit again. One thing also I thought you guys point out that was very important is Somalia is really, it's very homogenous ethnically and religiously. There aren't really, it's not divided by sect or ethnicity. It's, if there's a division, it's really more by clan structure. Is that right? And could you explain perhaps how strongly clan structure works in Somalia and how maybe it's similar to or different from sectarian differences or ethnic differences? I mean,
I've said this to Haroon before. One of the things that I find fascinating about Somalia is that the divisions in society aren't based on the things that you find elsewhere in Africa or really in the rest of the world. It's not like in Cameroon right now, they have a war going on between you know, French speakers and English speakers. Sudan, you had sort of an Arab population against an African population. Or in Nigeria, Muslims against Christians, at least that's part of the conflict there. But in Somalia, you know, they are all Muslim. They are all ethnically Somali. They all speak Somali. So you wouldn't expect these kind of deep, bitter divisions in society. But clan is the main way people differentiate themselves. And the clan rivalries have crippled every attempt to form a stable Somali government. Starting, I think, in the late 1990s, the UN began trying to create governments. They would hold these conferences. And what emerged was something called the 4.5 formula, in which Somalia's four major clans gets the bulk of any power in a government, whether that's parliament seats or cabinet seats, and then the minor clans get the 0.5, the kind of the leftovers. And I think, and the fact that this formula, even though it doesn't work really, even the fact that it keeps being applied to governments tells you how deeply rooted the clan system is in Somalia. As we say in the book, it is, it's kind of the air, it's in the air that they breathe. It's so much a part of society that there's no escaping it.
I was going to ask you and Haroon about this because I think most of us at least think we have an idea of what an ethnic group is, what a sect is, and how those things overlap in some parts of the world. But I don't think, as Mark was saying, that we have much of an idea of how a clan works. So I remember asking a Bosnian Croat, how do you know when someone is from Bosnia is a Croat or a Serb or a Bosniak? And he said, you can't tell until they start talking, and then you can tell. In Somalia, can you tell what clan someone is from when you meet them? How is that settled?
No, you can't tell somebody from his face. Nothing on his face says he belongs to clan X or Y. The clan system is very traditional and historical. And before independence, before Somalia became a nation state, people have lived along clan lines. And they have shared tradition, they have shared religion, they have shared language, but there were also conflicts, and conflicts most of the time were based on grazing, water resources, and land. So the conflict would normally take place between clans that reside in particular parts of the country. So the clan system was very important in the life of ordinary Somalis, not only on the negative side, but also on the positive side. People mobilized when they wanted to build something, or a school, or a town, or help each other. Even today, when somebody needs assistance in Somalia, he gets injured in an explosion or another tragedy happens. People help each other, not only along clan lines. Clan is still a factor, and people help each other because of the clan they belong to, but also other clan members, other Somalis come along, come alongside each other, and they help each other along clan lines. So the clan system is very important. And when the state collapse happened in 1990, the rebel groups that toppled the government were primarily based on clan lines. And that's why the state collapsed, and the national army, which Somalia used to have one of the strongest armies in Africa. But in 1990, when the state collapsed, the army dispersed and soldiers went back to their clans, and we engaged in a civil war. And this civil war was largely taking place along clan lines. But even then, people have mobilized in their own respective regions, and they have tried and worked hard to restore some stability in their own area, even though the central government was non-existent, was not functioning, was not providing any services or security to ordinary citizens. The clans mobilized themselves to fill that position in some parts of the region, for instance, in Puntland. Somaliland was slightly different because when the state collapsed in 1991, they immediately set up their own government consisting of different clans. But the clan system was very important to reconciliation. Unless you fix the clan problem in Somalia, or the clan difference, or clan enmity, you can make a lot of progress. That's why in politics, as Dan explained it, you have to base power sharing along clan lines. All the clans should be reflected in any governing system. the story of Al-Shabaab is slightly different, how they use and utilize clan system. They use it to their own advantage. We can talk about that. But the clan system is very important, both in negative and positive ways.
Let's go back to a bit of a timeline here. So I just want to go through a few of these things that happened to give people sort of a sense of how things developed. Again, we talked about how in 1967, there was a democratic election, the new leader, power transferred to the new leader peacefully. Power was given up voluntarily by the first leader. And then he was assassinated in 1969. And that's when a name who was sort of familiar to me from the 90s, Mohamed Siad, wait, how do you pronounce it properly? Mohamed Siad Barre? Barre?
That's correct, Mohamed Siad Barre.
Barre, yes. He wound up emerging out of a coup, a military coup. I mean, this is pretty much when democracy, the early democracy experiment was essentially destroyed. And he adopted a kind of what was popular at that time among the sort of the anti-colonial movements in Africa and a lot of the developing world. He adopted sort of leftist politics, a leftist nationalist politics, I guess. You know, made Somali the national language, nationalized banks. As you said, you know, the KGB moved in there in a big way, bought weapons from the Soviet Union. That was a big thing as well. Which side in the Cold War did you buy weapons from? And then in 1977, Siad Barre invaded. If you looked at a map, John brought this up earlier, both of you did. If you actually look at a map of where ethnic Somalis or Somali-speaking people live, I mean, a huge number of this map, it's like a big blot, live outside of Somalia's, the country's borders. A large portion of them live in Ethiopia in the Ogaden region, and another sizable chunk live in northeastern Kenya as well. They have a pretty sizable group there. So I don't know exactly what sparked that invasion, but it sounds like at least initially I don't know whose side, who was at fault necessarily. I don't know how much it matters. But initially, the Somalis took about 90% of the Ogaden territory. And then when the Soviets and the Ethiopians, with Cuban backing, actually, got involved, they pushed them out. And it seems like things started really kind of going downhill from there politically within Somalia. In the 1980s, the Siad Barre government just wound up losing more and more control. And then you kind of have this this moment by 1990 when chaos is really starting to come in. The Soviet Union is collapsing, and you have some of these people that have been to Afghanistan that have really been radicalized by the new kind of Mujahideen radical Islamism coming back into Somalia. And one of the first figures that you guys write about is Al-Afghani, and he's an interesting figure. He spent several years in Washington, D.C. He was scooping ice cream and driving taxis, and he winds up becoming one of the leaders of the new Islamist movement. Can you talk about Al-Afghani and sort of his trajectory a bit?
Well, as you mentioned, he lived in Washington for about 7 years in the 1980s. He grew up in Somalia. In the what is now Somaliland. And then he, according to a relative that we talked to for the book, he wanted to experience life in a foreign land. So he came to the US and he kind of kicked around Washington for a few years. He was taking economics at the University of District of Columbia. But according to a roommate of his that we talked to, he was spending the bulk of his time at a mosque, one of the biggest mosques on the East Coast, the Islamic Center in Northwest Washington. He got more and more involved in that place and in just Islam in general. It was sort of taking over his life. And then in 1987, Abdullah Azzam, who's one of the originators of the jihadist movement, he passed through Washington. He was raising money for Islamist fighters fighting the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. He met Ibrahim Al-Afghani. At the time, he was Ibrahim Jamamiya, Ibrahim met Abdullah Azzam.
Abdullah Azzam is sort of the guru in a sense to Osama bin Laden, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
I mean, it's just kind of incredible. I know I've been heard this in different times, you know, very far apart. That, oh yeah, one time, you know, he was going around America raising money in the West because we had different priorities at the time. But it's still kind of like, it's like a little jolt that shocks you when you hear it. Still, you know,
especially because Azzam, if I recall correctly, was a radical Palestinian, and right. And radical Palestinians were not really very popular in the U.S. in the 1980s, but when they were raising money for the Afghan Mujahid, who Reagan idolized, I guess there was an exception.
Yes, yeah. So Azzam convinced Ibrahim Jamamiyad to come to Afghanistan, and Miyad, his student visa was expiring anyway.
Right.
And he chose not to marry an American citizen so he could stay. Mm. So he went to Afghanistan, and who did he meet but Osama bin Laden and the other people who founded Al-Qaeda. And he stayed with the group even after Azzam was killed toward the end of 1989. And after about a couple of years, maybe 2 or 3 years in the Al-Qaeda orbit, he went to Somalia to plant the roots of jihad there in January 1990, right as the Mohamed Siad Barre government was disintegrating right. under the pressure from multiple secular rebel groups in Somalia.
So one thing that your book implies is that Al-Qaeda, as it was developing, bin Laden and the group around bin Laden, always had a special sort of plan for Somalia as sort of a safe house, basically, if things went wrong in Afghanistan. Did that develop this early?
Yeah, that developed very early on. Just to give you a little bit more background in this, there was a Salafist organization that was established in 1983 in Somalia. The name of that organization is Al-Ittihad Al-Islam, and that is the Al-Shabaab is an offshoot of that organization. So this was a Salafist organization. Majority of the members who founded this organization were trained in Saudi Arabia, so they already had that exposure to Salafism and Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia. And the number of organizations that were based in Saudi Arabia were offering scholarships to Somali students after the collapse of the state. Siad Barre left power in January 1991 mm-hmm. after about a month or so battle in Mogadishu. So Al-Ittihad Al-Islam was preparing for that moment. Mm-hmm. And when Siad Barre left, it was the perfect moment for them to come out, because Siad Barre was not an Islamist. He was against it, and he was very much keeping them under the ground. They were, all they could do was contact students in universities, spread some of their ideologies in the civil service, in the military. So that's where he kept it. But when he left, this big opportunity came. And then Ibrahim Haji Jama, Mi'ad Al-Afghani, who was not a member of Al-Ittihad, but he was a member of the organization Al-Wahda Al-Islam, which is one of the organizations that founded Al-Ittihad, but he was in Afghanistan. He came and he merged with Al-Ittihad, and he, along with two others who came also from Afghanistan, they set up the first jihadist training camp in Somalia. in 1991 in the town of Kismayo. Kismayo is the third largest city in Somalia after Mogadishu and Hargeisa. So it's very strategic, has a seaport, access to one of the largest forests in the country, very fertile land, a lot of farmlands. Mm. So that's where he set up his training camp. And then from there on, they succeeded to train several hundred militias. Every year from thereafter, they were encountering some challenges. Initially, because of the civil war that was taking place in the country, they immediately clashed with a warlord, General Muhammad Farah Haidid, and the jihadists were defeated in that battle, but they never went far away. They regrouped and then they reemerged in another part of Somalia in Puntland. Then again in 1992, just a year later, they clashed with a local warlord by the name Abdullahi Yusuf Ahmed, who would later on become the president of Somalia. Mm-hmm. And Abdullahi Yusuf defeated them. Then they moved to another region in Gedo, southwestern Somalia. Then in 1995-1996, Ethiopia crashed their bases in that part of the country. Ethiopia saw them as a hostile force, and indeed it was documented that Al-Ittihad helped the rise of a small group of militants inside Ethiopia carrying the same name, Al-Ittihad al-Islam, in Ethiopia. That's what they called. So, and they tried to assassinate a number of Ethiopian officials, including a high-profile Somali minister. So Ethiopia crushed them, and then they came to Mogadishu, and that's when the split happened within Al-Ittihad. Some of the scholars, the leading scholars, decided to give a violent jihad and go to preaching, and the young firebrands, youngsters, who had connections with Ibrahim Afghan and the jihad in Afghanistan, had another idea, and they decided to continue. They sent a lot of men to Afghanistan. One of the most successful operations that Ibrahim Afghan succeeded in doing was to take young Somali jihadists from Somalia to Afghanistan to expose them to global jihad, also to go to universities in Pakistan. A lot of Somalis were studying there, and take some of them across the border into Afghanistan. And one of the people who he helped and mentored at that time is Ahmed Abdi Godene, who will later on become one of the founders of Al-Shabaab, but also the second leader, the most successful leader, the man who structured the current organization we call Al-Shabaab.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to just go over this one more time again for our listeners here. You had, so there were Salafist groups. Salafism was not really native. I mean, it was not popular in Somalia before the 80s, and before some people started getting trained in Saudi Arabia, right? If I'm not mistaken, it was more a Sufi brand of Islam. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. And so then you had these Salafi groups that formed. They formed a new group. The initials, which would be easier maybe for some of our listeners to remember, would be AIAI, Al-Ittihad al-Islam, that you talked about, was formed out of two main Salafist groups and some others. And as you said, they fought and lost against Farah Hadid. They lost badly. They lost badly in the Puntland in 92. But in 1993, to some degree, they and their Al-Qaeda contacts played some kind of role in training up the fighters in Mogadishu who took on the Americans in the famous, you know, Black Hawk Down events, right? I mean, it's hard to know how much, what kind of role that they played, but it certainly played a big propaganda and mobilizing and recruiting role for the Salafist jihadist fighters ever afterwards. It became kind of a legend for them. Can you talk a bit about that?
It is a little bit fuzzy, what the connection was between AIAI and Al Qaeda leading up to that incident. But there was definitely interaction between the groups at the time. There was a couple of AIAI members helped Al Qaeda members sneak into the country after the U.S. troops landed there at the end of 92. And there was some interaction regarding the training and the and attacks, not the day of Black Hawk Down, but in other attacks on U.S. troops. There was some bombings of, I believe it was Jeeps, convoy.
Mm-hmm.
And Bin Laden later claimed that his men were involved in those attacks. And in a video years later, actually it might have been a radio interview, Ahmed Ghadane, who was the emir of Shabab, he also claimed that Al Qaeda and AIAI were involved in those attacks. And there was a U.S. Indictment regarding the...
So there were indictments of some of the guys who were involved in the bombing of the embassies, right? And there seemed to be some intermixing there between the embassy bombings in Eastern Africa and then some,
Yes. So the bottom line is the whole thing was a little bit fuzzy, still is a little bit fuzzy to this day. But AIAI was helping Al Qaeda sneak into the country and helping them get in position to attack U.S. troops at that time.
Right. I have a quote here from your book where Ghadane, or you quote Ghadane, he said Osama, sort of paraphrase-ish, Osama bin Laden said that moment, that is to say the battles with the Americans that was memorialized in Black Hawk Down, that is when we found out the weakness of the American military. So it certainly, and so that would be at least from the Al Qaeda and that wing of jihadists from their point of view when they first started seeing America as the next Russia Soviet Union and felt emboldened that they could sort of do an Afghanistan on America as well. Anyway, so moving forward, so 1997, this is an important time. I mean, for other stories we've covered, because for example, 96, 97 is when Chechnya became, they won the first war against Russia in 96. They did the peace deal, and so they were independent until 99. And they sort of, Chechens kind of show up in this book every now and then as among the foreign fighters in Somalia, which I hadn't heard that before. But also they too, at least the jihadist faction, the Basayev faction, some of those guys went also and trained after the Taliban took over Afghanistan. And it's also important because the Taliban, when you read a lot of how al-Shabaab ruled, you know, you start thinking it's sort of some midway point between the Taliban and Islamic State ISIS. Anyway, I'm jumping ahead here. So 1997, AIAI splits into two factions. And one is sort of a Salafist anti-war faction, but the other faction, which eventually kind of turns into al-Shabaab, they call themselves the new Salafists, right? I guess the translation would be sort of new Salafists.
Correct.
Yeah, and then in 2000, and it's not the same thing. This was something that was confusing to me, and now I understand after reading your book a lot better, and it's frustrating also in a way. The Islamic Courts Union is not at all the same thing as al-Shabaab. For those of us who kind of had a second-hand grasp or third-hand grasp of what has happened in Somalia, it's something quite different, even though the Shabaab people infiltrated it and so on. But Islamic Courts Union forms kind of officially in 2000 in Mogadishu. So could you tell us who they were when they formed you know, what support they might have had?
This is very interesting part of the Islamic movement in Somalia. Actually, the first Islamic court in Somalia emerged in 1991, just a few months after Siad Barre left. But that Islamic court was set up by a man who would later become a warlord. His name, Musa Sud Yalahu. in a small neighborhood in Mogadishu. And in 1994, that Islamic court spread to northern Mogadishu. Still, these Islamic courts were run by Sufis and businessmen. All they wanted was law and order, because the warlords were not providing any law and order. Nobody else was providing, filling that gap. So they came in and they set up these Islamic courts. But those Islamic courts run by the Sufis clashed with the local warlord, and then he closed it, all the courts. So for about a period of 2-3 years, there were no Islamic courts at all in Mogadishu. Then again in 2000, they re-emerged. The same Islamic courts run by moderate religious scholars, funded by businessmen, activists, and primarily they started working as neighborhood watch, and then they developed into courts, and they succeeded in taking civil cases, mediating between people, and in some cases they attacked in powerful individuals, gangs who were kidnapping civilians and innocents and children of rich people, and they succeeded in rescuing those people who were being kidnapped. So they have gained a lot of support from ordinary public, and then they have succeeded in spreading to most of the districts in Mogadishu and some of the towns outside Mogadishu. But this new group, the new self-jihadists, who knew exactly what they wanted, who had connections with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, who were also harboring or giving safe haven to the three men who were suspected of involvement in the U.S. embassy bombings in East Africa, infiltrated. And one thing they used in doing that was the clan system. They did not just, because the courts at that time did not have a union. The union only emerged in 2005.
I see.
Before that, these courts were completely based on clan lines.
I see.
So they were being funded by businessmen who belonged to Clan X. So each businessman was supporting the Islamic court of their respective clans. In 2005, they merged, they came together, 11 Islamic courts came together, and then that's when they formed the Union of the Islamic courts. So they used the clan system, the new services, to infiltrate. So they started with their respective clan courts. So for instance, Aden Airo, who was the probably the greatest military commander of Al-Shabaab, was the commander of the forces of his clan's Islamic courts. So even though they had their own connections and they knew each other what they were doing exactly, but they were not sharing their secret with anybody. But they were embedded in these Islamic courts. And they knew each other. They were organizing themselves separately, training their own militia separately, but they're using the Islamic court as a cover.
Right, because for listeners, the ideology, the jihadist ideology, would not recognize clans. I mean, it's a, I don't know how else to put it, like an internationalist ideology, right? It wouldn't have borders like that. But for this specific mission, they would take advantage of different jihadist members, clans, relationships to clans in order to infiltrate and get into these Islamic courts, right? So,
correct. Even today, if they think they can achieve a purpose, a goal, they will use the clan system to their advantage. They are very adaptable. They do anything that's going to, and we're talking about Al-Shabaab, they would do anything that would help them achieve their goals. They would use clan system to raise money, to recruit people, to achieve their goals.
So they'll have always that that advantage that they can play both sides, or, you know, be either clan or global or whatever, internationalist, when it suits them.
Yeah, or sometimes they would pit clans against one another, sort of a competition thing to see who could help the group the most.
I see. So can you describe then real quickly, like, who... So the Islamic courts, then, before it became this kind of political union in 2005, was it actual courts? And who were the judges? Who were the people who were judges? Were they clan elders, or were they actual lawyers or businessmen? I mean, how would they appoint who the actual judge was, and how much political power did he have? And then also, I'm sorry to keep piling this on, but was there a parallel state structure at that time, that it was a discredited parallel, whatever was left of it, state court structure that just people just had ignored by that point? Or
One important thing we have to mention is that in 2000, when the Islamic courts reemerged in Mogadishu, a Somali government was also established in Djibouti with the help of the Djibouti government, Somali clan elders, politicians, other activists went to Djibouti, and a government was formed. And this government came back to Mogadishu, and because the Islamic courts at that time were run by moderate leaders, it appealed to the Islamic courts to work with the government. So they handed over men and weapons to that government. But the government was short-lived. It was immediately opposed by the warlords. One thing they succeeded in Djibouti at that time was to, they have given more power to the clan elders and civil society, instead of the warlords. So the warlords did not see their interest in that government. So they went to Ethiopia, and they had a meeting in Ethiopia, and they formed an alliance to oppose this government and undermine this government. And they succeeded that. So the government was weakened within 18 months. Mm-hmm. So the Islamic courts, when they saw that, they took back their men and weapons, and they continued functioning and operating. So that's how they operated until 2005. Right. So the question you asked were, who were the judges? The judges were Islamic clergymen, people who studied the religion, who can apply the judgments, and the rulings would be based on the Quran and the Sunnah. The Sunnah, the word is of Prophet Muhammad, and the Quran, the word is of Allah. So they would take cases based on the Quran and the Sunnah, and civil cases they would take. They would also listen to land disputes, and they would go back to documents that were available, that under Siad Barre, if they can't find, there were some private individuals who took custody of some important documents, including documents showing who owns what land in Somalia. So they were collaborating with these kind of individuals in order to reach conclusions.
Mm-hmm. And my understanding is they were fairly popular as compared to like the warlords or some others. They were at least in Mogadishu or in some other cities, right?
They were very popular because at least they were providing safety, security. They were providing a sense of justice. Remember, what we're talking about is a country that probably at that time, 10 years, lawlessness, civil war, complete breakdown of law and order. People were desperate to have
and morality. When that happens, morality breaks down,
breaks down. People suffer. They don't know what's wrong. What did we do wrong? So a lot of people became very religious, not only religious, but also to support the Islamic courts. And a lot of people really wanted to have Islamic government at that time.
And then 9/11 happens, and we could talk about, you'll have to tell me how to properly pronounce his name, Rabaul, because he comes up again. He's Mokhtar Rabaul, is that right?
Yeah, Robo.
Robo, yeah, this is a really interesting figure we'll talk more about later. I didn't realize he was in a training camp in Afghanistan on 9/11, and he's now
Well,
you know.
Afghanistan keeps coming up here.
Yeah.
Afghanistan is where everybody meets and starts to understand the basic rules. And I'm just wondering if that Afghanistan experience allowed the group that became Al-Shabaab to survive so many defeats, because what you're describing is not, overnight success. They lost a lot of times, but they seem to have had more staying power than the other contenders.
Yeah, I think partially because of their training with Al-Qaeda, they adopted a long-term view where, they figure if they lose today, they'll regroup and reemerge tomorrow and fight again. And quite a few of the Al-Shabaab founders had that training, including Rabo, as you said. And if I can talk about 9/11,
Yeah.
Rabo was in a camp near Kandahar 10 days before 9/11, and Bin Laden visited the camp, called everybody together, and said, "We're going to hit America in 10 days." He didn't tell the group where or how, but he said they would need to be ready to relocate quickly because he predicted America would be bombing the country. And then 10 days later, it was nighttime in Afghanistan. Rabo comes out of his tent and he hears the sound of commanders celebrating because at that moment, the planes had hit the World Trade Center in New York. And then he got the sense that he would have to get out of Afghanistan pretty soon after that. And the Somalis who were training with Al-Qaeda, they soon after made their way back to Somalia and set the Islamic Courts Union on the path to sort of becoming a platform for Al-Shabaab and their brand of Islamic fundamentalism.
And Rabaul, I noticed, is now entering Somali politics, right? So he at least has survived a very long and bloody time.
Just to highlight earlier point how this jihadist is infiltrated the Islamic courts. Probably when he came back from Afghanistan, he became the deputy defense chief of the Islamic court. Airo, Aden Hash Airo, who also went to Afghanistan, became the commander of the Islamic courts, of all Islamic courts militias. That's after they set up the Islamic Courts Union. Hassan Airo was one of the ideologues. He did not go to Afghanistan, but he was always the ideological leader of this new Salafi jihadists. He became head of the Shura Council of the Islamic Courts. Ahmed Abdi Godane, who would become the most prominent leader of Al-Shabaab, was the secretary general of the Islamic Courts. So they have dominated, they have held key positions within the Islamic Courts. They had their own mobilization, their own understanding of each other, what they're doing. But on the other side, they were involved in the Islamic courts. And then, as you all know, when the jihadists came back from Afghanistan, the CIA and United States security forces, security apparatus, intelligence followed them into Somalia. Of course, they already had some suspects, as we mentioned it, people being connected with the embassy bombings in Somalia. And CIA made contact with the warlords to ask them help in capturing these individuals. They have succeeded in arresting a number of people, Yemeni jihadists, gentleman who is now the only Somali who is being held in in Guantanamo Bay, Gulet Hassan Ahmed.
Right.
The United States documents show that, says or claims that he was arrested in Djibouti, but his relative, his wife, who I spoke to, said he was arrested in Mogadishu at that time because the warlords were helping the CIA in arresting these individuals who they suspected of having links with an Al-Qaeda or with embassy bombings. But that CIA connection involvement backfired.
Yes.
Initially, it helped the warlords organize themselves in the same way the Islamic courts were organized to fight against the Islamic courts and the individualists that infiltrated the Islamic courts. But it backfired spectacularly because the Islamic courts defeated the warlords and they propelled it to success after success, taking over all Mogadishu, most of South Central Somalia. And every Somali in Somalia at that time welcomed. And I told you how people, how supportive were they of the Islamic courts. And they ruled South Central Somalia for about 6 months. And these 6 months was the, it's termed as the golden age because it was the safest period that Somalia experienced since the collapse of Siad Barre.
Yeah.
And then in 2006, it seems like a lot of things happened very quickly. It's a very complicated story, it seems like, at least to outsiders like me. The Al-Shabaab emerges on its own, having been, I guess, sort of a paramilitary group in ICU, and then declares ICU Sufi and too moderate, and they break openly, and then we get the war with Ethiopia. Can you explain how all that happened?
Well, if I could back up, as we mentioned, the CIA encouraged the warlords to unite and take up arms against the ICU. And the ICU and Al-Shabaab began working closely together. And there was about a three-month fight in Mogadishu for control of the city. And the ICU and Al-Shabaab, they won rather easily. The public supported the ICU. In fact, there's an interesting diplomatic cable from the U.S. ambassador to Kenya at that time. And he told Washington, the public is not going to support the warlords. He was absolutely right. So by June 2006, the ICU was in firm charge of Mogadishu, and they take control of most of South Central Somalia over the next 6 months. But the divisions between Al-Shabaab and the more moderate members of the ICU began to open up. Shabaab made moves to enforce, their own strict brand of Sharia on the country. They wouldn't, for instance, they wouldn't let people watch the 2006 World Cup.
Right. I imagine that was really unpopular in Somalia. A lot of places in the world it would be, but I gather that with Somalians really unpopular. Yeah,
it was very unpopular. Yeah. But Al-Shabaab didn't care,
right?
And they actually shot two people who were watching the game in a public cinema. And then in August of that year, Al-Shabaab formally organized itself into, before they had been kind of an informal group, now they were a formal group, Al-Shabaab. And toward the end of the year, Ethiopia was watching this and getting nervous that the ICU and Al-Shabaab would threaten the transitional government's lone remaining stronghold in Beit Doa. And Ethiopia sent troops into Somalia to protect Beit Doa. This was an issue of some disagreements, at least initially, between Ethiopia and the United States. Meles Zenawi, who's the prime minister of Ethiopia, he was very gung-ho about the idea of sending troops across the border and confronting the Islamic forces. And behind the scenes, various U.S. military officials and envoys, diplomatic envoys, were saying he should think twice about doing this. Maybe, you know, don't do it at all. But then toward the end of the year, he apparently convinced at least some people in the State Department that this was the right decision, because Jendai Fraser came out and announced that the ICU, they are Al-Qaeda to the core,
right,
which was not really the case.
And Fraser is the top diplomat at that time in 2006 in the State Department, the Bush administration, right? For Africa.
Yes. Huh? Yes. Right. Yeah. Okay. And so this leads up to the clash between the Islamist forces, meaning the ICU and Al-Shabaab, and the Ethiopian army in December of 1996, when the Islamist forces decide that they are going to attack Baidoa. And over a period of about a week of fighting, the Ethiopians overwhelmed both Al-Shabaab and ICU, because they had mainly, even though Al-Shabaab in particular fought very hard and fought very much like a conventional army, the Ethiopians simply had more firepower. They had aircraft and tanks. And that's something that has always hampered Al-Shabaab, even to this day. They don't have the heavy weapons, the heavy armor that they would need to defeat a conventional army. But going back to 2006, within a matter of, I think, 8 or 9, the Islamists lost control of first of South Central Somalia and then Mogadishu, and the Ethiopians moved in. And so...
Yeah, they collapsed really quickly, right? It must have been surprising how they just, the whole structure just melted.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so by New Year's, Ethiopia was in control of the southern part of the country and the capital, and that was not received well by Somalis.
But I was going to say, in a sense, that was good for Al-Shabaab. It was a complete disaster for the ICU, and this was something that the Americans didn't see at that time. I mean, again, going back to 2006 or even a little bit earlier, from your book, what I gleaned is that the CIA kind of had this, in hindsight, the CIA made some big mistakes here. They sort of looked at Somalia and thought, well, we'll do the Northern Alliance plan that we did in Afghanistan. It's basically, you know, the same thing. So we'll throw a bunch of money at the different warlords. So long as they bring us some of the wanted terrorists, we don't really care what they do. But of course, what that wound up doing was turning the whole population against the warlords and unifying the ICU. The ICU winds up coming to power, and this is kind of surprising. Right after they take Mogadishu, they send a letter to the U.S. Ambassador Bellamy, trying to open the door for some kind of cooperation. But Bellamy's response in a cable to Washington is, "We got to null." He says some of these leaders need nullifying, which basically means taking them out. So we lost kind of that opportunity. And then, as you said, Deputy Secretary of State Fraser in December 2006 said that the ICU is Al-Qaeda. And this was a shock to most, Somali watchers, longtime Somali watchers. So it seems like there was kind of an opportunity lost to have a deal with the ICU, which was clearly a lot more moderate and certainly a lot more popular than Al-Shabaab. But the Ethiopian invasion destroyed the ICU, and then after that, you have Al-Shabaab basically gets to completely own a kind of a nationalist uprising against the foreign occupiers, the Ethiopian foreign occupiers, right? So that starts in 2007.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, 2007, we entered a completely new period for Al-Shabaab, for Somali politics, for regional security. What happened is that a battle ensued in Mogadishu between a faction of the Islamic courts, which called itself Muqawama, or the resistance, or the armed wing of the Islamic courts, and Al-Shabaab, and they were initially collaborating with each other against Ethiopia. Then because of the pressure and the bloody fighting in Mogadishu, Ethiopia thought it needed the support of other countries. And just to give you a little bit more background, when the Somali government was formed in Nairobi in 2004, the Somali parliament voted for the deployment of African Union peacekeepers, but it excluded neighboring countries, Kenya, Ethiopia, and Djibouti, because these countries had very serious interest stake in what's happening in Somali politics. So Ethiopia found out in 2007 that the war in Mogadishu was not leading to anywhere. It was losing a lot of men. And then the Somali parliament and the Somali government reached out to African Union, and for the first time, a contingent from the Ugandan government, from Uganda, was deployed in Mogadishu in March 2007. And these troops would later on take over from Ethiopia in terms of protecting the Somali government in Mogadishu. But on the other hand, the war with Ethiopia emboldened Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab was able to recruit a lot of fighters, was able to raise a lot of funds. It received massive support from all sorts of people, not only Al-Shabaab, but also Muqawama, the armed wing of the Islamic courts. Mm-hmm. The political wing of the Islamic courts took refuge in Eritrea, and they set up the Alliance for the Liberation of Somalia, a political organization that was mobilizing, helping, giving political leadership for the fighting inside Somalia against the Ethiopia. And this is when some defining moments happened, because this is when a large number of young Somalis who lived outside Somalia in the West, in the United States, in Europe, in the Middle East, have decided to go back to Somalia to join these two groups, the Muqawama and Al-Shabaab. And initially, the objective was to join the Islamic courts, especially the Muqawama, and to fight against Ethiopia. That was the primary objective. But when they went to Somalia, the only organization that was mobilized, that was organized, that was ready to receive them and utilize them was Al-Shabaab. So they fell into the hands of Al-Shabaab, and they took part in the fight against Ethiopia. And Al-Shabaab became the most powerful organization in Somalia in 2007-2008. Mogadishu was destroyed unlike any other time in the past, and that destruction and the killing of civilians, thousands of civilians, just helped to the cause of Al-Shabaab, and they were able to recruit lot of people who were aggrieved by the brutality of the Ethiopian military in Mogadishu at the time, which was documented by human rights organizations at the time, which in fact very brutal.
Yeah, you guys describe fighting. Some of this. It's really classic horrible insurgency, counterinsurgency warfare from what I gather from your reporting. You know, Al-Shabaab would do a suicide bomb or fire some mortars from a neighborhood where they have people, and then that would invite from the Ethiopians a massive artillery retaliation. They didn't want to go in there with their troops, but they would go in with, well, they would just fire all their artillery, which they had a lot of, and tanks, and obliterate entire neighborhoods, and they didn't care because they would get riled up and angry. And all that did, of course, was make Shabab more popular, make Ethiopia more unpopular, and thousands of people dying, and hundreds of thousands became internal refugees, right? So
yeah, it becomes a really, I mean, in a brutal way, it becomes a very effective way for al-Shabaab to emerge, because they have these organizational skills that are better than any of the other contenders, and they can survive defeat. And anyone who harbors nationalist feelings is going to see that this is now a war of Somali against foreigner, and they become the Somali champion, I suppose.
Yeah, not only a foreigner, but Ethiopia, as we mentioned right. earlier, Ethiopia was the historical
right.
Enemy of Somalia. Ethiopia and Somalis have been fighting for a long, long time over territory, over land, over grazing, over many things. And many Somali nationalists have really also supported this fighting against Ethiopia, because when they saw the Ethiopian tanks in the capital, the presidential palace of Somalia, that was too much for right. a lot of ordinary right. people.
Well, this is something that we see a lot in these broadcasts, is that, I mean, a lot of people who haven't seen the way insurgency works take the idea of an Islamist insurgency way too literally. Like, there can't be any nationalism, because if you're going to be very strictly Salafi, then nations don't exist. As al-Baghdadi said, Iraq is not for the Iraqis, Syria is not for the Syrians. But in fact, if an Islamist insurgent group seems to be fighting more effectively than other people, a nationalist, say a Somali nationalist in this situation, can very easily adapt to that.
Yeah, I wanted to just step back for a second. You mentioned organizational skills.
Right.
Al-Shabaab, they did have superior organizational skills, and they used these to reach out to Somali nationalists, both in the country and abroad. One of the things they were doing in 2007 and 2008 is they were taking advantage of the then new technologies of social media. So they were reaching out to people on Facebook and putting videos on YouTube and holding, and this is not social media, this is just technology. They were holding conference calls with people in the United States,
right.
Who wanted to either come to Somalia and join the fight, or at least raise money for the fight. So they had active fundraisers in Minnesota, where there's a large population of Somalis, of course, and in San Diego and in other places. This was the kind of outreach that really wasn't possible 5 to 10 years right. earlier. When Abdullah Azzam was coming through America, he had to travel.
Right.
He had to go see people personally.
Right.
But now Al-Shabaab can reach out to hundreds or thousands of people with just a click of a mouse.
Right.
And that also made a difference in separating Al-Shabaab as sort of the preeminent resistance group to the Ethiopians.
Well, we've seen Al-Shabaab now in a really strong phase. And your book makes a very good case that Al-Shabaab hit a kind of peak around 2008, 2009. What happened after that? What went wrong if they were so strong at that point?
I guess we should talk about Ghadani a bit too here, right? Yeah.
Yeah. What happened is that in January 2009, the organization I just mentioned, the Alliance for the Liberation of Somalia, which was based in Asmara, Eritrea, had reached an agreement with the federal government of Somalia, the Mogadishu-based federal government, with the mediation of the United Nations. So a meeting was held in Djibouti And the president of the federal government, Abdullahi Yusuf, resigned it a month earlier. Ethiopia was very angry with him, so he was pushed out. Ethiopia felt that they were bogged down and they needed an escape route, so they pushed him out. He was pushed out, he resigned, and they went to Djibouti. So the federal government and this opposition group reached an agreement. A government was formed. The new leader of this government was the leader of the Islamic court, Sharif Sheikh Ahmed, who was a moderate religious leader. And when he became the president of Somalia, he came back to Mogadishu. And earlier I mentioned it to you, Muqawama, or the resistance, the armed wing of the Islamic courts, came with him. They supported him. And that agreement in Djibouti also led to the departure of Ethiopia from Somalia, and which was a key demand by the Asmara-based group. And in return, they accepted to join the government and accepted the constitution. So the government moved to Mogadishu in February 2009. At that time, a group of Islamic scholars led by former Al-Ittihad Al-Islam scholars who knew this young group, these young jihadists who are leading Al-Shabaab, some of them were their students, have decided to come out and form an Islamic umbrella, Islamic organization, to give fatwa on key decisions. So they gave a fatwa, and their fatwa was, let's work with the government, let's accept this government. It's being led by an Islamic court leader, it's an Islamic government. And they tried to convince Al-Shabaab to work with the government. And right. In return, they have pressured the government to ask the African Union troops to leave. So they set the timetable, and they reached out to Al-Shabaab if they want to accept this deal. So this is where the split with right. Al-Shabaab came. Some of the Al-Shabaab leaders thought it was a good idea because they thought, well, we succeed against Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. Ethiopia left Somalia. We are now a very strong organization. We can have a big say in what happens in the country from now on. Let's turn our victory in the battleground into a political one and reach a deal that's good for us. Mm-hmm. But other leaders within Al-Shabaab, including the leader at the time, Ahmed Abdi Godane, and probably the majority of the leaders, thought otherwise. And they said, including Robo, at the time, Robo was he told us that he was for the negotiations, but the statements he was making was contradicting that because there's a famous quote from him which says, there's no difference between Sheikh Sharif and Abdullahi Yusuf. The only difference is the hat. Sheikh Sharif used to wear a hat. Mm. So they primarily rejected that deal. And politically, in terms of leadership, Al-Shabaab was weakened, but militarily there was not a lot of weakness within Al-Shabaab. And while the negotiations were taking place, Al-Shabaab actually launched a massive military attack in May against the federal government in an attempt to overthrow and take over the rest of Mogadishu.
So, I mean, it sounds like since the new president, the new leader, was a leader of the Islamic Courts Union, that it had more of a real base of support than people sort of gave credit for at the time, and that it sounds like maybe Shabaab gave credit for as well. Is that right? I mean, did this new transitional government, even though it was sort of cobbled together from outside, even though it still had support from outside forces. It had more local support than the previous government.
That's absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. The problem and the differences between Al-Shabaab wing and the Islamic courts, although Al-Shabaab, as we indicated earlier, was embedded in the Islamic courts, they never agreed with them.
Right.
They were never ideologically close to them. Even though they were part of the Islamic courts, they were loathing them. They were gossiping them, how incomplete their religious belief is, and they would describe them, call them names.
Oh, I can imagine this is like the trolling must have been epic, right? Because when you have people with sort of ideological pedantic differences like this, and they're fighting each other, yeah, I can imagine the trolling must have been intense, right?
That's absolutely the case. And then the full battle, the bloodshed started in Mogadishu. Hundreds of people died. More houses, more properties were destroyed. Mogadishu again destroyed. The Somali government held on. The mandate of AMISOM, which was just to protect government installationists and government leaders, was changed. And now, in 2010, AMISOM was ready to fight alongside the weak Somali security forces. They were weak. They did not have enough weapons. They were not getting salaries. But at least they were determined, and they were also battle-hardened. They were fighting against Ethiopia just few months ago. So, but they were determined, and they defended the government, and eventually they forced Al-Shabaab to withdraw from Mogadishu in August 2011.
It seems like Mogadishu is the big prize in this fighting. I guess we should remind listeners that most of the fighting we're describing is happening in southern Somalia or central Somalia, right? I mean, northern Somalia has already gone its own way, or it's several ways at this point. So most of the fighting is over the big city of the south, Mogadishu. And after losing Mogadishu, if I recall your book correctly, Al-Shabaab retreats to the countryside north and west of Mogadishu and controls the villages?
Well, over the next 2 years, after they pull out from Mogadishu in August of 2011, they gradually lose control of other cities. They're pushed out of other cities in many cases by AMISOM. AMISOM from 2011 on was on sort of a general offensive against Al-Shabaab. And when they got, as more troops came into the country, initially they only had 6,000 or 7,000 soldiers. But by 2011, the Kenyans had joined, the Ethiopians had joined, and they had more than 20,000 troops now. They had, I think, 22,000.
Burundians. I was surprised that there were a lot of Burundians, right? Some contingents from Sierra Leone, but yeah.
Yeah, the Ugandans and the Burundians made up the backbone of AMISOM. And then they were joined by Djibouti, Kenya, and Ethiopia. And now once they had the manpower, and given that Al-Shabaab had also suffered heavy losses in the 2 years of fairly continuous fighting in Mogadishu, now AMISOM had the upper hand, and they pushed Al-Shabaab out of Kismayo, Beledweyne and other cities that and Baidoa, as well as Mogadishu. And so Al-Shabaab is reduced to holding some villages and some countryside, just sort of general rural areas. And they certainly don't back down. They when AMISOM or the Somali National Army takes a town, sometimes Al-Shabaab will take control of the roads around the town and impose a blockade. So they're still making life hard, but they don't have the, by 2012-2013, they no longer have the power, the military power that they had had a few years earlier, and they're also being divided internally because several of the leaders are rebelling against what they see as the mistakes by Gaddafi. And there's a pretty bloody purge of the group's top leadership. Gaddafi's the loyalist factions of the Amniyat, which is al-Shabaab's intelligence service and sort of almost like its presidential guard, they kill Ibrahim al-Afghani, who we mentioned at the beginning of this interview, and several others, including a man named Omar Hamami, who was al-Shabaab's main English-speaking spokesman to the world. He was from the United States. He was from Alabama.
Can we talk about him real quickly? Because this is a really colorful, interesting... I have to admit, I don't remember him somehow. It kind of... Or I have a vague memory of it, but he's...
I had only a vague memory. Yeah. I think I was getting him mixed up with Al-Laki, but...
Yes. So can you talk... I mean, this is a guy who's not even Somali. He's... So I guess he would be classified as, you know, your classic foreign jihadi, but he's from the Gulf Coast of, he was born and raised in the Gulf Coast of Alabama. His father is Syrian, Muslim, Arab, and his mother was a local Christian Alabaman. I don't know which one of you wants to talk about him. It's kind of an interesting story, though.
I'll be glad to talk about him. You know, he kind of, I get the impression he sort of got a romantic notion about going to Somalia and fighting against the warlords and the Ethiopians. He had converted to Islam earlier. He had become intensely Islamic, starting in high school and then it deepened during college. And he had a wife and daughter. Mm. He lived in Toronto for a while. But then this idea of the Islamic Courts Union rising up and taking over from the war, an Islamic state, even a moderate Islamic state, I think got to him. And he went to Somalia in 2006. And when he saw that al-Shabaab had emerged as the preeminent Islamist group in the country, he kind of introduced himself to the group and sort of worked his way in. They didn't trust him at first.
I was going to say, I would have thought, I mean, I would just think they would assume, well, this guy must be a spy or has a screw loose or something, right? I don't know how Somali, and especially from a secretive group like that, how they would even let him in.
Yeah, I mean, Hamami was a slightly, he was a funny character. He was not, he was a serious guy, but he was not too serious for al-Shabaab. He would rap, he would choke, he would speak out, and al-Shabaab do not speak out.
Right.
Don't have to say anything. Even if you know the facts, you don't say anything.
Right.
Yes, he was always getting angry at the leadership, it seemed like. And there was a while where he was actually tweeting out his squabbles with the al-Shabaab leadership
and trolling them.
And you had the feeling that he wasn't going to last very long, and indeed he didn't last very long.
He lasted a few years. He was probably in their good graces for 2 or 3 years. His videos on YouTube certainly attracted a lot of attention. Although not necessarily maybe for the reasons that Shabaab wanted.
I got to say, some of his lyrics here that you guys quote, I mean, this is like reactionary rap. I don't even know how else to call it. But one of his lines here, bomb by bomb, blast by blast, only going to bring back the glorious past. So, and this is a guy who, you know, a few years later might have been attracted to the ISIS, the Islamic State Caliphate. And that's why, as I mentioned, you know, sort of the beginning of the show, you guys bring up that what al-Shabaab created over territories that it ruled was sort of like a proto-ISIS, not as extreme, but kind of getting there, right?
Hamami was he was a strange character. He was close to Robo, Hassan Dahrawi's, the opponents of Al-Shabaab leader. He was a good friend of Mukhtar Robo.
Interesting.
And I think Al-Shabaab believed it. When the social media, Twitter, jihadists at some point in 2010, 2011, a lot of Al-Shabaab fighters opened their own Twitter accounts. Mm. And Al-Shabaab believed that a large number of these accounts was actually run by Hamam himself and his friends. So he was using fake name and he was telling stories about Al-Shabaab and their leadership and how they are not sticking to truth, how they are distorting Islam, how they are antagonizing good religious people. He was not naming anybody, but he was criticizing the leader of Al-Shabaab sometimes by name. He posted a number of videos saying, I was threatened, I was my life is in danger. And if you speak out like that on social media, mm-hmm. Al-Shabaab believed he was behind the social media campaign. Then when he posted the videos of him saying, my life is in danger, Al-Shabaab put a lot of pressure on him either to go to another country or to keep quiet. Mm-hmm. But he married a local woman, mm-hmm. and he assumed he was adopted by, funnily, he was adopted by a clan in Somali, and he would claim he belongs to clan, one of the clans, one of the major clans in Somalia. And he was mainly in that part of the region, which this particular clan, Rahawain, resides. That's where he was mainly operating, but he knew that his time really with Al-Shabaab was limited, and he was not the only one. As you rightly mentioned, Al-Shabaab never fully trusted foreign recruits, foreign jihadists. So they actually mistreated them, they camped them in remote camps, and when they come, they would confiscate all their possessions, mobile phones, passports, everything, and they would send them to these camps. And then they would immediately put them in the front line, send them to participate in wars or commit suicide attacks immediately before they change their mind or understand the situation while they are hot and hungry. Al-Shabaab would engage them. So Hamami wanted to set up his own foreign fighters wing of Al-Shabaab. Mm. And Al-Shabaab did not want any other group really to operate alongside Al-Shabaab fighters. So they eventually, I interviewed him in September 2013, and 12 days after I interviewed him, he was killed.
That's amazing. Wow. Did he have a sense that he was in danger, that he was going to be killed?
Yeah, actually, I didn't contact him to interview. He contacted one of Al-Shabaab defector who lived in Mogadishu, who was a friend of him, and he said Al-Shabaab was looking for him at that time. So they wanted to find out his whereabouts because the videos he was posting. They went to his house and they asked his wife about his whereabouts. So she didn't tell them anything, but she called him and told him that Al-Shabaab is taking them somewhere. So he was very angry that Al-Shabaab is messing around with his family. Mm. So he wanted to speak out. So he contacted this friend and he said, let me speak with any journalist, local journalist, because Al-Shabaab is now attacking my family. And this defector was somebody who I interviewed before, and he said, well, Hamami is ready to be interviewed. Would you be willing to interview? And I said, okay, fine. So we set up the interview, and I interviewed him during in the first 3 minutes of the interview, which is now online. He talks about why how Al-Shabaab attacked his family, and he was very angry. And then I asked him about his differences with Al-Shabaab, the United States, and whether he would want to return. The highlight, the key point of the interview was that I asked him if he ever wanted to come back to the United States. And he said, that will only happen in a body bag.
Jeez. Wow. Huh. But how did you find him personally? I mean, did he seem charming, you know, for lack of a better word? Did he seem a little crazy? Did he seem scared? I mean, what was your sort of general impression?
At that time, he was in hiding somewhere in the hinterland, the forest.
Mm-hmm.
So he was really very scared for his life. But also, because of his flamboyant lifestyle, he did not fully understand the risk or that Al-Shabaab could pose.
Right.
So he was, he knew exactly what he was doing. He thought by speaking out, he could change the minds of some of the Al-Shabaab people. He thought he was doing something unique, that people within Al-Shabaab needed to speak out and say something. And he was not happy with what was happening. But that does not mean he disagreed ideologically
with
Al-Shabaab. He disagreed the treatment he was getting and other foreigners were getting, and some of the Islamic scholars, Robo and others, were getting, Al-Shabaab scholars, I mean, were getting. But ideologically, he was not that different. He was...
The quotes that you have from him seem to imply, if he had any objection, it was that Al-Shabaab was not being Islamic enough for him, which often happens with foreign converts, I think, to any belief, that they start telling locals who've grown up in the belief that they're doing it wrong, which must be kind of infuriating.
I think his line was, you're either pregnant or you're not.
Mm. Ah, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's either Sharia or no Sharia. So I think we've kept you guys a long time. So maybe is there a way that we can wrap up?
Yeah, let's kind of move it forward. Ghadani is killed. He's by an American. Is it a drone that takes him out? I can't remember now. And this is really the brains and mind behind Al-Shabaab's rise, at least in its first incarnation. And then Ubaidah takes, who's the new leader again? I'm sorry.
Abu Ubaidah, right? Uh-huh.
Ubaidah. I guess the one thing, before we wrap up, I think what we know that's happened since Al-Shabaab's sort of military fortunes went downhill is they turned to, what we would call like terrorism, spectacular terrorism, whether it was the attack on the Westgate Mall in Kenya, or that incredible, horrific truck bomb that they set off in Mogadishu last year, killed almost 600 people. So what happened in the last? I mean, I don't know if you could tell us a little bit about the difference between Ghadani and Ubaidah, and then where they are right now, like sort of where they're.
I think Ubaidah has been focused. He had to start from a different place than Ghadani did.
Mm-hmm.
Ghadani became emir at the end of 2007 when Al-Shabaab was on the rise. And Ubaidah took over at a time when Al-Shabaab had hit an all-time low.
Right.
Ghadani was killed on September 1st, 2014. And Al-Shabaab had just lost another one of its towns. And Vida had to rally the group and find a way for it to fight effectively against AMISOM and the Somali National Army. And so his early tenure was about, I think, getting new recruits and trying out new tactics. One of Shabab's most effective tactics has been attacks on remote bases that were intended to help the government control the new areas that it had, you know, it captured from Al-Shabaab.
Right.
And previously, when Al-Shabaab did suicide attacks, they would send four or five gunmen into a hotel or a base and just cause as much havoc as they could before they were killed or killed themselves. But starting in 2015, they began doing these large-scale assaults on remote AMISOM bases. They would start with a suicide attack of some kind, a bomb blowing up on the perimeter of the base, and then hundreds, or between dozens and hundreds of Shabab fighters charging the base. And this first worked against a Burundian base in June 2015, and I think 53 Burundian soldiers were killed. The base was overrun. Shabab was able to nab a lot of the weapons and ammunition from the base. And Shabab repeated this several times, most spectacularly in 2016 against a Kenyan base in El Ade. And they killed 140 Kenyan soldiers.
Wow. Yeah. Did they get this tactic from the Taliban? I seem to remember this shocked everybody when the Taliban did the sort of suicide bombings at the edge of a base and then pouring in hundreds of fighters. Maybe I'm wrong on that.
I don't think it was like a brand new tactic
right. That
Bob devised, but
it was new for them though, and it was new to the AMISOM as well.
Yeah. And in the El Ade case, Kenya tried to hide the extent of its losses, but it was undermined in part by an offhand comment by the Somali, I think it was the prime minister, but also Al-Shabaab filmed the assault as it was taking place. And this propaganda video was put online, and it showed the fighters very effectively charging the base and blasting their way past these kind of lame-looking makeshift walls, and taking over the base and shooting a Kenyan soldier who was emerging from a tank with his hands up in the air, looking certainly ready to surrender, if not fully in surrender mode. But somebody shot him in cold blood. And this was all online, so it was very embarrassing to the Kenyans. So Obaida has sort of introduced these new tactics for Shabab, and also under his rule, the group has increased its fundraising, increased its extortion efforts among Mogadishu businessmen, and in general, they've built themselves back up into a formidable force, although not. They're not acting like a conventional army like they did in the early years under Gaddafi. They haven't tried to take over Mogadishu again.
Right. It sounds like they understand that they don't have the conventional means to fully take over the country, but they think they can outlast through endless painful guerrilla warfare. AMISOM, is that sort of the strategy?
That's absolutely their strategy. They know that, as Dan rightly said, they know that they cannot overthrow the Somali government now as long as African Union troops are there to support the government. But they can buy time, they can recruit, they can function, they can raise funds. They can train more people, more suicide bombers. They can develop new ideas, new techniques. Al-Shabaab always comes up with a new idea in terms of attacking, assassinating people. They're very resilient. They're very adaptable. They're very patient. They take their time. They will take like 2 or 3 years just to assassinate or carry out an explosion or attack on a hotel or a target they wanted to take out. So they are very, they know the situation in Somalia. The only power that can destroy them in Somalia is fully functioning Somali army, less corruption, very strong government with a strong, viable justice system, police functioning, local government functioning, fight against corruption, effective security branch, very strong counterterrorism, and soft power. Reach out to their fighters, offer them alternative, use people they can understand, scholars, Salafi scholars who can talk to them out of this situation. So any Somali government is going to need to employ that kind of approach in order to minimize the risk, reduce their power, and in the long term, defeat them.
We saw an interesting story about Robow that he is now, as I mentioned, running for office in Somalia. And this is something you see when a lot of governments try to defeat long-term insurgencies. They try to co-opt one of the insurgent leaders or
Or
several of them.
disaffected ones,
Yeah. So what does it mean that Robow is now running for office in Somalia?
Robow is also a strange character within Al-Shabaab. He, as we mentioned, he trained in Afghanistan, a former Al-Ittihad Al-Islam fighter, a former Islamic courts official, deputy leader of Al-Shabaab, spokesman of Al-Shabaab. But on the other hand, he was pragmatist. He acted like a clan leader. He was connected to his clan. He was behind the scenes, helped some of the politicians. Something that Al-Shabaab leaders would never do is to free Somali politicians who were captured by Al-Shabaab. He did that. He was talking to Al-Shabaab to release his clansmen from Al-Shabaab. He was talking to Al-Shabaab sometimes on behalf of aid organizations. He was asking them to let welfare program and other organizations stay in the country so that at least they can deliver some of the food. So although he was diehard jihadist with Al-Shabaab, on the other hand, he understood the importance of clan and having constituency. So he never cut relations with his clan. And when he left Al-Shabaab, he only fully defected last year, but he left the group a bit earlier, and he went to his hometown where he was born and completely cut relations with Al-Shabaab. But he was with his clan, and protection was provided by his clan. So his association with the clan never stopped it. And now this Southwest Regional Administration, which is largely in Bay, Bakool, and lower Juba, lower Shabelle regions, three regions dominated by his clansmen, he saw an opportunity where he can reinvent himself, relaunch his ambition. He knows people are not going to understand about his association with Al-Shabaab, but he believes that not many politicians in Somalia are clean or have clean past background. But he also has some support, and he believes he's playing the card that the Islamic courts played, which is they can provide security, there will be less corruption, He's using what he learned. He's mobilizing people from grassroots level, while his opponents and other politicians are trying to woo the votes of MPs. He's going to the tea shops, coffee shops, to talk to the ordinary people. So he's trying to create a very strong base that will help him become the leader of the region. If not now, maybe next time.
I saw that the U.S. withdrew. The government had a $5 million bounty reward on his head, and they just took it up. I mean, it seems like counterinsurgency people have gotten a little smarter than they were 10, 12, 15 years ago, because it seems like smart, among other things, counterinsurgency, to not kill him or try to block him when he's trying to kind of come out clean, right?
Yes. The U.S., incidentally, they pulled off the bounty for him in 2017, before he defected, or at least reached an agreement with the Somali government. But yes, the U.S. has gotten much smarter about allowing former insurgency members to kind of reassume a role in society.
Right.
This wasn't a case of an insurgency, but in Kenya in 2013, the U.S. came out in opposition to Uhuru Kenyatta running for the presidency of Kenya. And he had been, indicted, or at least accused, of war crimes related to the 2007 post-election violence in Kenya. The U.S. came out against him. They said elections have consequences, and it backfired.
Mm-hmm.
Kenyatta was elected president.
Right.
And maybe this time the U.S. decided we're not going to, at least publicly,
right,
we're not going to oppose this, in hopes that maybe Lobo will flame out on his own, or he just won't, he won't be elected. He won't get the support he needs.
The interesting thing is that the foreign diplomats are going to Baidawa, and they have been shaking his hands.
So they're betting on him. So maybe we could close this up by asking both of you, what do you see as Somalia's future? Is Al-Shabaab going to hang on, grow and triumph, be defeated?
I mean, the important thing we should mention is that there is an impasse now. The government needs really substantial support, way, way, way more than the support it's getting now from the international community, in particular support to the security forces and to the justice system and to investigative teams, counterterrorism units. So this is what the government needs. On the other hand, the government is still weak. Mm-hmm. And as long as the government is weak and African Union troops cannot go out and take over the whole country from Al-Shabaab, Al-Shabaab is going to stay. And they're going to buy time, borrow time, as long as they can, in order to reemerge. And as you rightly said, force international community to get tired of Somalia. That's their long-time objective, is to see international community say, enough is enough. Somalia is not defeating Al-Shabaab. It's not going anywhere. We're going to bail out African Union troops, going to stop funding AU troops, and it's up to Somalis what they're going to do. This is the time that Al-Shabaab is waiting. This is their main objective. Mm-hmm. But if there is a really commitment, strong commitment from the international community to support the government, and also not only support, but also to pressure the government to fight corruption and also fight all the conditions that are aiding Al-Shabaab to continue to recruit people, collect funds from businessmen, extortion from people. As long as those conditions exist, Al-Shabaab is going to exist. So there are hard choices, both for this government, for the international community, and until they turn that tide, Al-Shabaab is going to exist.
I have to admit, reading your book, I was kind of shocked at how stingy the EU could be. It's fairly small amounts of money. I know there's corruption there, but there's, you know, corruption in a lot of places. But it seems like they you know, raise a huge fuss over granting a few hundred thousand here or $1 million there. And with the U.S., it's more like the U.S. will get angry and sort of grouse and not give any money out until there's just an absolute crisis. And then everybody panics in Washington up to the top and they throw a bunch of money and resources and then forget about it again. But it seems like, I don't know, that was kind of my impression reading that sort of the edge.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. The level of support to Somalia is peanuts. It's negligent. It's absolute nothing. And Al-Shabaab is one of the strongest militant organizations in the world today.
Yeah, and very innovative in the sort of the jihad movement. So I would think they would take more interest, but yeah.
I hate to end on a pessimistic note, but I have to say I see Somalia remaining locked in a stalemate for some time to come. Al-Shabaab doesn't have, and I don't think is going to gain the strength to take over Mogadishu, let alone all of southern and central Somalia, the way it almost did in 2008, 9, 10. But as Rune said, Amisom and the government don't have the power to push Al-Shabaab into some kind of non-existence. Mm-hmm. So I think the status quo is going to hold for some time to come, at least until Amisom makes a decision to withdraw.
Mm. Well, we have a saying on this show, and on that happy note.
Yes, exactly. On that happy
on that happy note, yeah. we should probably end the interview. We've kept you quite a while. Thank you both for a brilliant interview.
Thank you again to our guest Haroon Maarouf and Dan Joseph, co-authors of the book Inside Al-Shabaab, The Secret History of Al-Qaeda's Most Powerful Ally. Okay, that was a really great interview with, and really thankful again to both Haroon Maarouf and Dan Joseph, the co-authors of Inside Al-Shabaab, The Secret History of Al-Qaeda's Most Powerful Ally. And
John, I know it's really late there. It's like 1 a.m, so I don't want to keep you. I only wanted to ask you, I mean, it was a depressing interview. And as you said, we like to sign off on our shows in a depressing note. But I wanted to ask, did you know where you're going next? Since you said before the show, yeah.
We're responding to listeners' requests because listeners were complaining that we haven't devoted enough time to Latin America. So Catherine and I are going to go to Latin America.
Whoa. Okay. Okay. Do you know where?
So far, it looks like Buenos Aires.
Wow. Maybe
I can brush up the old high school Spanish again. Yeah. It must be in my brain somewhere. God knows where. Yeah. I mean, that place is a mess. But it's probably under some old roll-up desk somewhere, and maybe it'll come back.
Oh, wow. That's cool. Okay. So you're going, and it's going to be summertime. I think, right?
That's the bad part. Yeah, I hear summertime in Buenos Aires, which is December, is a lot like summertime in New York City.
Really? I thought it was drier for some reason. Well, anyway, you'll find out. But that's still, if you're going to, I mean, one of these days, the traveling around is going to end, and hell, now's a good time to go and, you know. And
yeah, we could check a new part of the map.
Absolutely.
We pretty much got that map covered by now, but now we're going to check off a big one.
Yeah, and we've had some shows about Argentina and the wars around there, so you can get more of a bird's eye view of that as well. And we had Gabriel Uriarte. We had two Argentinians on the show, Gabriel Uriarte and Ignacio
Portes
as well. Yeah, so good.
Yeah.
All right, all right. Well, good luck with that. And thanks again to everybody for supporting the show. Thank you. Really, to Haroon Maarouf and Dan Joseph for joining us. Get the book
great
Inside
interview.
Al Shabaab.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a great book.
It really is. Yeah.
If you want to understand how insurgency works.
Yeah. And all right. So we'll talk to you soon, John. Thanks again.
Okay. Bye, Mark.
Bye,
Brian.